From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, who is celebrating his anniversary and also, I believe, a Cavaliers championship in the Finger Lakes this week. Happy anniversary, Evan. We are midway through Summer Book Week, and so it is only fitting that our connection this hour is right at the midway point between writers and readers. We're going to talk about what the role of publishers is in a world where anyone today can self-publish pretty much anything they want. We have a roundtable with us in studio. Peter Connors is the publisher of BOA Editions, BOA Editions, the dean of Rochester's small presses. They are marking their 40th anniversary this year, and we will hear more about that celebration this hour. Stephen Huff is the founder, editor, and publisher of Tiger Bark Press, a 10-year-old local publisher with a focus on poetry. Chad Post is freshly back in Rochester from an adventure in rural Texas, which we will hear about later this hour, and he is with Open Letter Press at the University of Rochester. And Nina Alvarez is the founder of Dream Your Book, which provides services including editing, self-publishing, coaching, and book proposals to aspiring writers. And she is also at the helm of a new startup press called Cosmographia. So we've got a nice cross-section. We hope to hear from you, too, at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 on Twitter. I am at Scott Feibusch, and we'll let our guests introduce themselves on Twitter as we go as well. Peter, I want to start with you because in a lot of ways the whole story of small presses in Rochester kind of starts with you, and 40 years.
Yeah, it's amazing what a small press has accomplished here in upstate New York. BOA Editions was founded in 1976 by A. Poulin Jr., who's a Brockport professor and poet and translator, and has grown and expanded and accomplished amazing things in 40 years of publishing. This year, 2016, we celebrated with the University of Rochester, who has recently acquired BOA's archives. So you can actually go to University of Rochester now, search through their archives, and find out a lot about not just the history of BOA, but the history of small press publishing in Rochester, New York.
That's fantastic. And of course, you have celebrations throughout the year that we'll be hearing about later in the hour. Chad, as we mentioned, you're just back from Texas, so let's talk about Marfa, Texas.
Yeah, so I was down in Marfa, Texas for about 5 weeks as part of the Lannan Fellowship Program, where the Lannan Foundation from Santa Fe puts up four writers at a time for these 4 to 6 week residencies to work on whatever you want to work on. And it's Marfa is an amazing place. It's a very strange, very interesting place where the Chinati Foundation is located. So Donald Judd has a lot of like art there. There's a lot of very artistic community, but a town of about 2,000 people. And I talk to more people now today than I did in most days in my time in Marfa.
3 hours from everywhere or anywhere.
Basically, yeah, absolutely. But I did get to work. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity to work on what you want to work on. And I ended up writing a 220-page manuscript on the future of publishing and book culture. So,
and we should mention that you know, publishers oftentimes tend to also be writers. And Peter, I know you're working on a new Grateful Dead book that that is in the works. So we'll talk more about that in a bit too. Stephen, introduce Tiger Bark Press to us.
Tiger Bark Press is a very independent press. I started actually. I got into publishing at BOA back in 1985, and after I left BOA, I freelanced for a while, and then I decided I wanted to get back into publishing. So I started Tiger Bark Press with about $600 of my own money. We just turned out our 21st book, and I still have about $600. It's Bertrand Russell, public intellectual, and it's a new collection of essays on Bertrand Russell, and it's being released just in time for the international meeting of the Bertrand Russell Society this week at St. John Fisher College. So I might sell a few copies. Our focus really is mostly poetry, but we make forays into nonfiction.
Excellent. And Nina, you're here for two reasons. You're here because you are starting a press, and you're also here because for several years now you've been working with writers and trying to sort of be a coach and an assistant and talk a little bit about what you do First of all, with Dream Your Book.
So Dream Your Book is an author services company, and I like to be a one-stop shop. So I work on editing. I'm going to help. I can do coaching if there's a creativity issue. But also I want to be there for the publication process. So helping a book get out to agents and editors, or if the person decides to self-publish, through that whole process as well. The self-publishing leg is more involved, and I have a team of people for that.
What's the origin story behind this? How do you get into being in that line of work?
Well, that is, one of the major stories of my life really is, who thinks that they get to get paid to edit fiction unless they have to climb some ladder, over at Vintage? I was a copy editor in Philadelphia about 10 years ago, learning that trade, and went out on my own as a freelancer doing marketing writing a little bit after that, and was going to move to Paris and just work this freelance life. And then that fell through. There was a housing scam. It was all this whole thing. I lost all my money. But the light at the end of the tunnel was that my friend, they had a press called WK Publishing, and they were getting a lot of fiction manuscripts, and they just didn't want to do fiction. They wanted to only do nonfiction. So she said, look, you want to try this out? And I got my first client. That was 2009. And that book is now published. I kind of cut my teeth on that. But I wouldn't have been able to do that if I didn't write my own work and edit my own work constantly,
And now you are branching out into publishing also.
Yes. Well, I actually did have a small press at the same time called In Conundrum, and we had a book of translations by the translator Pierre Joris. And I learned how difficult it is to sell books over the period of a time. So I pulled back, and then just this last year, I had an opportunity to publish Dimitri House Stories, which it's a collection of true stories of Rochester's homeless written by a woman, Fran Morse, who worked with them for a quarter century. And it just felt necessary. And I know how to publish, so I gave it a shot. And that's Cosmographia so far.
The landscape certainly has changed. I mean, there was a point where being a publisher meant that you had to have access to expensive printing capabilities. And now you can get something printed very easily. Set up for me kind of what the barriers to entry now are if somebody wants to hang out a shingle and say, okay, now I'm a publisher.
Well, there are none, I guess. That's where I come in, and I really, really have to stress that you want to look professional. You want to put your best work out there, and that's why having a layout person, having a professional cover designer can help you just, if you think that, if you're a newbie and you think you can do it, you're probably wrong. But there really are no boundaries. And what the true, it's very democratic. If you have a good book and a good looking book, or even a good book, like you could have 50 Shades of Grey, if you're hitting a nerve, people will respond to. But really, honestly, you could go home right now, open up Word, write whatever you want to write, upload it to CreateSpace as long as it's your own, and have it published on Amazon in a couple days.
It's the getting anybody to read it, however.
That is the hard part.
So let's kind of set up the landscape here. We were talking in this hour yesterday with booksellers and librarians about sort of where they all fit in. And there was sort of a consensus on both sides of the table, really, that in a world where you've got the giants that are Amazon, that are Barnes & Noble for however longer it hangs on as a big box retailer, that there are still niches, that you can be a bookstore, you can be a library that becomes a community meeting space, that becomes that third place, as they call it, where people can connect with each other and get personalized recommendations. In the world of publishing, I know as I was trying to reach out for some of our national authors that we have on this week, and let me get the plug in, we got Richard Russo coming on tomorrow afternoon at 1, very excited about that, to talk about his new book, Everybody's Fool. But it's amazing for all of the different names that still show up on the spines of the book. You actually go to start writing to publicity people, and every single email these days ends with at Penguin. there are a couple of big companies that are controlling this on the big end of publishing. What's it like a little bit farther down the food chain? What's the ecosystem like these days?
Well, I guess I'll return quickly to that last question and just say, to me, there's a big difference between printing a book and publishing a book. Printing is an actual process whereby, you know, paper goes through a printing press or whatever it might be, a computer, and it comes out and there's words on a page. That's printing. But publishing involves then taking that book, marketing that book, working with that author to develop that book. There's an editorial process, you know, again, marketing and promoting. And I think when you have a press like BOA Editions, especially, and all the presses here, there's a certain understanding when a book comes out from an established press that the quality is going to be there. We know what to understand from a BOA Editions book. We know that there's been a vetting process. At BOA Editions, we get roughly 1,000 manuscripts a year in for 10 to 12 publishing slots. The competition is fierce and the selection process is rigorous. And Jenna Fisher, our marketing director, does a wonderful job, as does Melissa Hall, pulling together to get the work out into the world. And it is, as you say, you know, we're competing against some bigger heavyweight publishing houses. Fortunately, we're in poetry mainly. We do a little fiction, but we're mainly in poetry. The pool tends to narrow greatly. And at that point, believe it or not, Little BOA Editions does rise to the top of the list as far as getting people's attention for poetry books out there because we've been around a long time and because of our track record.
And if poetry is challenging, getting books out that are in translation, Chad, has got to be even harder.
It can be, yeah. Open Letter Books does all literature and translation, 10 titles a year from around the world, and we're based at the University of Rochester, which I think you may have mentioned earlier. It can be difficult, although a lot of times we like to treat the books as a book and not as a book in translation, as if it's being somehow diminished, although there are different audiences. And one of the things I wanted to respond to both of you about is that what seems to be happening mostly is that we have a very fragmented publishing and book culture in the best and worst of ways, in which the big presses, Penguin Random House, who controls like 65% of all books published in the world, can take over and create a book or make a book anytime they want to. The thing that I worked on in Marfa includes bits of stories on City on Fire, the book by Garth Riss-Kahlberg, a friend of mine who got paid a $2 million advance. And the second that advance was paid, that book was slotted for review in every single major publication throughout the country and was made and is being made into a TV series. That sort of like automatic publicity will never happen for one of our books, I don't think. But at the same time, we have people like Archipelago that does literature and translation that once James Wood reviewed Carol Ove Knausgaard's My Struggle, that book is now slated for a review in every single major publication. So there are different ways, and there are people who do self-publishing and people who are good at self-marketing, particularly within their genre, and work within their particular fields. And the way that booksellers seem to tie in, for us at least, is that we have a lot of bookseller fans, and that bookstores act as curatorial repositories for certain types of books and are working on the face-to-face communication, which goes deeper and is more interesting and more viable for a book culture than, say, the Twitter conversation, which tends to be everything ramped up to 20 and trying to get followers and create buzz, but that doesn't necessarily relate to sales or to an actual conversation about literature. Mm-hmm. So I think everything being sort of fragmented allows people to find their way and to find their particular audience. And we do a pretty good job with that with our type of books and our sort of readers.
Yeah. Steve?
Well, you know what? What previous generations of publishers of poetry had that we don't have today is the reader who goes out to a bookstore and scans the shelves and looking for something that's looking for something new and interesting. Most of the poetry that sells today, at least in the United States, is sold at readings and public appearances, sometimes course adoptions. Even the publisher who's a rank beginner knows that those kind of connections have to be made, that the author has to be nudged to go out and do readings and wherever possible. I mean, a place like Writers and Books, for example, or Downtown Writers Center in Syracuse. The books that are sold there, also an author will usually sign them for the reader, and that makes them non-returnable, which is which is a wonderful thing, I think. Yes.
Or do they just come back and sell them as a signed copy at that point?
Well, strictly speaking, a book that has scribbling in it is not returnable. You see, returns is a difficult thing. The what what we have in the book industry, which is unlike probably a lot of other products in the marketplace today, is that if a store doesn't sell a book, well, they can return it to the press or return it to the distributor. So you can see your sales soaring because Barnes & Noble ordered a lot of copies of your book, and then all of a sudden, whammo, they return 90% of them. Mm. So it's a risky business. You can say that, well, because of print on demand, we don't have to make these big investments in printing as much now, but to cover orders and then to have to suffer the returns, it can be pretty scary. I don't know. Peter might be able to talk to that.
This just happened to us too. There's also to distinguish between like print on demand as being like people think of that as like single copy as a copy is needed being printed, which generally isn't how it tends to work. It's usually short digital print runs, which are like 500 units, 750, anything under 1,000. And those tend to have a very high unit cost compared to if you print 1,000 copies from a traditional printer. So sometimes the cost benefits are very difficult. But we have one of those. We've ended up in multiple situations where we'll sell out of a book and have a few hundred copies on order, and we hold on waiting for those returns to come back to fulfill those. And if they don't, then you're like, we missed out. But if they do, then you get to like try and do that. There's Bruce Penderson that runs Bruce McPherson that runs McPherson Press always said that the last print run that you did is always your biggest mistake.
We are talking to local publishers here on Connections on Summer Book Week, and you can reach out to us too at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Ricky is on the line with us in Rochester. Hi, Ricky.
Oh, hey, man. Thanks for having me on. Cool panel, man. It's cool to have some bookheads on here for the week. This is awesome.
Thanks.
I just wanted to kind of shift the conversation just a touch, if you don't mind. Do we, like I got Apple TV. I got, like, a high-speed internet at my house on my phone. I got a tablet thing that I found, and I got that thing dialed up. And like, I can get, like, movies. I can do like music videos. I just watched a Hoobastank concert on my phone yesterday. Do I need like how have time to read? We've got all this awesome stuff like piling in, all this information piling in, the bandwidth, man, it's not big enough for the books. Are you seeing that shrinking because of all of this media that we have?
Well, let me ask you before we turn it over to our publishers panel, do you still find time for books?
Oh man, I've been trying to read Infinite Jest for like the last maybe 12 months. I'm on page like 42, I think.
Well, you're not alone there.
Evan, at one point said to me, hey, you want to do a David Foster Wallace show? I said, you know that means I'm going to have to read Infinite Jest, right? And he smiled and he said, yeah. And I haven't actually finished it, but I had him given to understand there isn't really an end to it per se.
Not really.
It just kind of keeps going. So I'm somewhere in the 800s though on it. So let me throw the question out to the panel. How do you...
I mean, do we need all these books?
Well, there's
great, so great many questions. I'm still catching up on.
There's no doubt that it's tough to compete with a good Hoobastank show. but, you know, the truth is that as a poetry press, we tend to have our readers already set. Chances are, if you're finding BOA books, you're already interested in poetry. So they're probably not choosing between, you know, Hoobastank or poetry. It's probably pretty much a foregone conclusion that they're already interested in the language and creating those images in their minds and connecting different thoughts and so forth. And I think, you know, one of the things awards are a funny thing in writing and especially in poetry. And in some ways, I can sort of poo-poo them and say, well, awards are, you know, a small thing and that's not really what we go for. But the truth is, one way that smaller presses can sort of get an edge up in the marketplace is by getting awards and getting accolades. And the truth is, our authors are really dedicated to their artistry. And a lot of times these awards celebrate the artistry. So we have a book coming out called The End of Pink in September by an author named Catherine Nuremberger. She just won the James Laughlin Award. Now, this is the second book award. It's the biggest second book award that you can have in the country. And, you know, there's 1,000 books get bought and mailed out and so forth. A lot of great publicity that goes along with it. So I think that, you know, a lot of times your audience is there. They're sort of waiting and they trust that a book coming out from BOA is going to satisfy that itch that they have for great poetry. And so the competition doesn't become as much of an issue.
I am absolutely convinced before we get to Chad here.
If you did like a BOA reality show, like would more people be learning about BOA because they're watching it on TV versus just the books?
Well, we have a great internship program, and you can come in and live that reality show every week by helping us at our nonprofit organization.
I wanna say that, Joe. Thanks for the call, Ricky. I am absolutely convinced, Peter, that you've got a side bet with somebody going, I bet I can get them to say Hooba Stank on public radio. somebody's getting $20 at the end of this somewhere. Chad, you wanted to respond to that?
Yeah,
too?
Two things. Like, one thing is that, and we like to do traditional books that are, some of them, as the one that you're holding, Gesell Dome by Guillermo Sacamano, is like 550, 600 pages long. And I know that I could cite various like studies and information about what happens to your brain when you read versus when you're watching TV or other things, and how it fires off a lot more portions of your brain and the deep experiences that happen. But the thing that I like to emphasize more is that books help slow us down, that we're too fast right now. There's too many things that we're taking on too fast, and that books actually have a very therapeutic benefit of being able to allow you to pause. It's almost meditative. But at the same time, we've got this forces, especially online and not even online, but James Patterson has launched this new series of book shots. Have you heard about these? That they're going to be sold in like the checkout aisle of grocery stores, that James Patterson and his team of creatives write that are all under 150 pages that are supposed to be half the length but twice the impact, which is horrifying to me, and I hate that. And at the same time,
which
we have things like...
Which are just contracted out to a stable of writers to produce an assembly line.
Exactly, and then they're just supposed to be like small, fit-in-your-pocket, quick reads because that's what people want. And at the same time, we have new media forms like Medium.com, which pretends to be some sort of like writer, reader, publisher amalgam of things, in which every one of their articles that's written on there, like you can, anyone here can join, you can write anything you want, you can be picked up by a quote unquote magazine on Medium, and every one of those articles will be ranked by how many minutes it will take you to read it. So I've heard people that create apps talking about like, well, what we want is a way so that instead of reading a book like One of Us is Sleeping, which I'm holding, you go on your app and you say, I want 15 minutes of reading material, and it gives you 15 minutes of reading material, which is a horrifying way to approach the idea of art and language as well. But, you know, I'm the mean, cynic old person here. So.
I'm not going to lie. One of the reasons why I love doing this is the second year now that we've done Summer Book Week, is it gives me an excuse to turn off the TV, step away from the computer and say, you know what? I got this pile of books to read. No, by the way, it's work. I got to do this. Except maybe it isn't. Don't tell anybody. It is Connections from WXXI. It is Summer Book Week. I'm Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson, we've got a roundtable of publishers in with us. Peter Connors from BOA Editions, which is turning 40 this year. Stephen Huff from Tiger Bark Press. Nina Alvarez from Dream Your Book, and now from Cosmographia as well. And Chad Post from Open Letter Books. You as well, as we return right after a quick break here on Connections. Next hour on Connections, we turn from local publishers to first-time local authors as Summer Book Week continues. Rachel Hall teaches at Geneseo. Her first book, Heirlooms, is a collection of interlinked short stories about World War II and the Holocaust. And Lynn Rosen has turned from a long career in business and education to writing. She's just published her first novel, A Man of Genius, midway through her 80s. Stay tuned. They'll join us next hour here on Connections. You're listening to Connections on WXXI, WRUR, and WEOS. I am Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson as we continue at almost precisely the midway point in our Summer Book Week here on Connections. And this hour we are talking about the publishing industry and tangential to that, people's reading attention spans and how to get books out there in front of people. With us in the studio, Chad Post from Open Letter Press or Open Letter Books?
Open Letter Books.
Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester. Nina Alvarez from Cosmographia and from Dream Your Book, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, too. Stephen Huff from Tiger Bark Press in Rochester, and Peter Connors from BOA Editions, which, as we may have mentioned, is turning 40 this year. And you as well at 844-295-TALK. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch, and you can feel free to weigh in on that medium as well. We are all here on this particular hour, on this particular show, because we're all doing what we do in Rochester. And I want to put the question out, especially to the guests who weren't here with us last year, Stephen and Nina. What is it like doing publishing in Rochester? What's different here? What's better here, perhaps, than trying to do this in a larger community?
Well, I think the world has changed. That the center of publishing in America has always been New York, and to some extent Boston and San Francisco. But now I really think you can be anywhere in the country. You can be in Peoria if you want to. The difference is, for whatever that might be worth, there isn't another press necessarily next door or down Fifth Avenue from where your office is. So maybe there's the energy may be different, but I think what's good about working in Rochester is there is a very strong literary community here, and I think the community here is very supportive of its small presses.
Yeah.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, we have Writers and Books, which is, I think, the third largest literary center in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's indicative of the culture of Rochester in some ways, the literary culture. Rochester is also, I'm from here, so I can be honest, Rochester's also got a lot of people that don't care about reading. And, you know, but because of that, the community is very close-knit of those people that do read and write and publish. It's a good place if you want to write, if you want to go to give a reading, if you want to get to know people who are accomplished. You have a lot more access to them, I think, than you would in a larger city when you're more of just a face in the crowd.
I'm glad you mentioned Writers and Books. That gives us a chance to plug tomorrow's noon hour on Summer Book Week, because we will be hearing about the big transition there as the leadership turns over, and we'll have both the outgoing and incoming leaders of Writers and Books in here with us tomorrow talking about that, and we hope that you will join us in the noon hour on Thursday for that as well. Chad, you want to jump in on this?
Sure. We are doing translations and being part of a translation program at the university. What Rochester has served for us is that we've created a very nice community of translators that live in the area and work together at weekly meetings that we call PLUB, where we workshop translations, but also just knowing each other and supporting each other, that's actually been pretty beneficial. I think that there is the ability to be anywhere as a press is helpful because you can keep your overhead down a lot. Mm-hmm. It's much cheaper to be here than it is to be in Williamsburg or Manhattan, God forbid. The difficulty, I think, and you can get books. You can mostly get the books that you want to do, especially if you're doing translations, poetry, anything that's got its self-defined niche. The harder part is getting that buzz created and getting that made. Being in New York would lend us probably double the amount of attention that we get right now. We'd probably be more talked about. And Rochester doesn't quite have that because the DNC doesn't really cover books, and neither does City Paper, unfortunately. If they did, I think that we'd see a lot more attention being paid and an even better and stronger literary community that isn't the same group of 30, 40 people, but is expansive. And I would love to see that for the future.
But is Public Radio New York going to give you a whole hour to come in and talk about publishing?
And not a whole hour. I've been on a couple times, but yeah. No, not necessarily.
We want to get to the phones here. We've got several callers at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And Connie is on the line with us from Brighton. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Scott. Hi, and to your panel as well. I take a class with Nina. I want to just promote. She is the most enthusiastic presenter I've heard in a long time. But anyway, I started a small press because the books that I'm publishing and writing are all really hyper-local. They're all about travel within 60 miles of Rochester or Buffalo. And just trying to get a national publisher to look at that seemed like a pretty impossible task.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. And how is it going for you?
It's actually going well. I have my newest book is 60 Great Places to Go with Kids within 60 miles of Rochester. And, you know, kids are always really popular. Families love to find places to go. So the hardest part is, of course, getting the book out because of my own sales force. But it's gone well. It's got in the museums and in local bookstores.
Can I chime in here?
Please do.
This is something that, and I've spoken with Connie about this, this is one of the things that has come up for me in my business, because once I've worked with a writer on a book for a year or something like that, inevitably there would be talk about marketing. And so that's why this year I brought on Carolyn Baratella, who actually has an MBA and a background 13 years in marketing, and I'm teaching her about the field of book marketing, and she's bringing all of this knowledge over. And what I've learned from Carolyn just this year is that you really do have to think about your book like a product. And so, you know, she'll sit down and do a consult with someone and really, and we'll do market testing and, you know, taking a much more methodical approach than me and my creative mind had been doing. And so something like this, I would say for Connie, you know, it really makes sense to sit down with a book marketer and just talk to them for an hour about, you know, real strategies.
Mm-hmm. You know what else she could do?
Yeah, that would be a good idea. And I think you learn as you go along, but if you're already in marketing, you can apply it right to what you're doing.
Chad's got an idea. He's itching to jump in on
that. Now that book marketing and reviews are basically just listicles, what you should do is get in touch with BuzzFeed and get them to do like 10 places near Rochester, within 60 miles of Rochester, and the 10 foods you should eat while visiting them, and make a bunch of GIFs that have motion in it and share that a bunch of times on Facebook, and that is a key. That is gravy train.
Well,
I give you that one for free.
Yeah, I'm focused on Rochester and the area, doing readings and some sort, you know, maybe partnering with Wegmans or someone here, I would say. What we do is focus regionally and then online.
Thank you so much for the call, Connie. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you all.
All right, as long as we are on the topic of marketing, Peter joins us from Rochester, and you had a comment about marketing as well.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes. different people. Hi. Welcome.
Yes. So my question is actually also about marketability of books. So, you know, as that one man, Ricky, was saying before, it's very difficult when there are so many distractions like tablets and iPhones and all this technology. So my question is then, like, do publishers ever hire authors to write books on trending topics? For example, have you guys listened to or been following the EuroCup lately, recently?
The what?
The soccer tournament?
The EuroCup.
Football tournament.
Right now.
We'll have you take the answer off the air. I'm guessing hiring a writer to do something on a trending topic is probably not something that any of your presses are likely to be doing.
We don't, but that does exist. Yeah. And book packagers exist to do that, to capitalize. Like, there probably could have been any number of Copa America books or EuroCup-related books that someone could have put together if they had the foresight to it.
Oh, sure. I'm sure somebody out there has an instant book that, even if it's not on the shelves here, is on the shelves in Europe. We go to Roy. Steve in Brighton. Hi, Steve. How you doing? You've got a question about printing.
Yes, I just a year ago published a self-published book. It's my third book, first one through print on demand. Okay, and I did it through Amazon's Create Space, and I got good reviews nationally, and it sells. You know, 30, 40, 50 copies every month, which is just great. Okay, it's a how-to topic. But I have gotten a lot of comments from potential sellers that the resolution in the black and white pictures is so bad that they won't take it. And I'm looking for a publisher, you know, that could take that and do a better job with it. I don't think I can afford color because there are 200 pictures. But something nicer in the black and white. Wonder if you guys have a recommendation for that.
Are you looking to do
local would be extra.
Are you looking to do print on demand or for a full printing of multiple copies?
Well, I guess I'd like to stay with print on demand because I don't really want to become a bookseller. I don't want to come home from work at night.
Well, it sounds to me like you need someone to do your layout for you again, and you need to have a DPI resolution over 300. So that's just a technical issue that can be worked out.
It was, okay. It's just the Create Space is not a great place for that.
Well, I mean, I've published images through there, and they're fine. You just have to make sure that, you know, you get someone who, a designer, to get in there and make sure it works out for you.
Okay, I will accept that answer. I had a different experience. I had all professional people do it.
Oh, you did? Okay, I'm not sure what's going on there.
Interesting. There are certainly local printers that I've worked with. One of my little side projects, I do an annual calendar that I put out, and I've worked with a few different local printers, and there are some very good ones out there. I think in general you probably pay more for that than you would to have it printed somewhere overseas and ship back. But if you're looking locally, check in offline, and I would probably recommend some local printers for you.
All right. Well, thank you, guys.
If I could say something about that, I don't think that you're an advantage with any printer because it's nearby. I've been working with Bookmobile in Minneapolis for a long time, and it's the quality not only of the printing but the quality of the binding that keeps me coming back to them. 10 years from now, I'm not going to open up one of my books and the binding is going to crack. And it's worth it to go to a book specialist, not just a printer.
That's a good point.
I find I can tell, in looking through a lot of books to get ready for this week, and a lot of things that sort of show up in the pile here, you can tell which ones were self-published pretty quickly just by the quality of the cover and the quality of the layout. It tends to be not all that hard to figure out. We have one more printing question. This is Roy on the line. Hi, Roy.
Yeah, I know that writers and books and things think that, their world is shrinking, but in some ways printing's gone down drastically in many ways in this town. Well, it took on other forms. We went from handset, metal type, to photographic, to computer, and there were great examples. William Morris in his books, or the Doves Press, or the German, I can't think of it now, Kessler's Press. They fine limited edition copies, all craftsmen, French book covers, Japanese papers, but as Steve was looking at it, sometimes cost is a factor.
Sure, I appreciate
what becomes available.
There's probably a whole show that we could do just on the history of the printing industry in this town too. I had family members who had Great Lakes Press when it was over on Central Avenue back in the day, in Case Hoyt that competed with them on larger, not necessarily books, but larger printing jobs. That's an interesting question. I appreciate it, Roy. Yeah, certainly there is a whole universe out there of books as craft. Does that factor in to anything that anybody around the table is doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that at Boa Editions we absolutely take a ton of care in the physical presentation of our book. My philosophy on that is, you have an author, and let's say a poet, chances are they spent anywhere from, let's say, 2 on the low end to, 10, 15 years on a book. I want them to be just as proud of the physical book that they're holding as they are of the work that's inside of it. And one thing we've been able to do is create a visual art library through funding from the New York State Council on the Arts and the Rochester Arts and Cultural Council. And basically, we have an online library of all local Rochester-based artists' images. And one of the first things we do when we sign an author is we give them a password to this site. It's password protected. They can go and browse through all Rochester artists' images, and if they want, select one that we then use as the cover. And we have this brilliant, we have Daphne Morrissey as one of our designers, and another one is Sandy Knight, who takes that image and then creates this fitting book cover. We've had in the past few years over 30 Rochester-based artists on our book covers that then go out across the country and, in fact, across the globe. So it's been a wonderful way to create a local connection with the local visual arts world, and also make sure that our books are just gorgeous as they go out.
Well, you have that neat physical connection over there at BOA, too, that you are in a loft building right next door to Village Gate on Goodman Street that is absolutely filled with artists.
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful building. I would encourage anyone on First Fridays to come over and just walk around the building. There's all sorts of painters, potters, weavers, you name it. The art form is being done in there. And you can always stop by Boa Editions. We're on the third floor there and pop in and say hi and check out our books, too.
Look for the signs that say Boa is here.
That's right.
Interesting. There's been articles recently about the rise of print, the return of print culture, as they like to call it, because there has been an increase in print book sales and a decline in ebook sales over the past year. Although the irony to that is that a huge portion of it is attributed to adult coloring books, which made up 5 of the 10 best-selling books of all books last year and helped kind of make up that 2%. So,
I haven't figured out how to do here yet, but maybe next year. Do you do ebooks? Is your stuff available electronically for people?
Oh yeah, every book that we have the rights to, we do as an ebook, and that is nowadays basically all of them. Back in the beginning, we started as the ebook world was getting itself figured out. I think our books came out before the Kindle was launched, in fact. And with international rights, because we're acquiring the rights from agents who are based in Spain and France and Germany and wherever. Frequently, they were very hesitant about giving up ebook rights initially because they felt like ebook equaled piracy. Nowadays, it is absolutely commonplace. The bigger conversation in ebooks has revolved around the pricing of them and how the pricing and how royalties work. And that is still a little bit in flux, although it's pretty much been nailed down now for books of our sort. For the 99 cent and the $2.99 books in the self-publishing world, that is still a wild west that's very entertaining to read about and think about. But
Nina, what do you tell your clients about this?
About specifically what?
About ebooks and about how to figure out some of these questions that Chad's raising.
Well, I think it's always wise to have a paperback and an ebook version. Why not? Especially ebooks, you have no inventory, no overhead. I think that what I feel, and this is really what's really different, is that we have 3 amazing presses here that are acting as vet people. They're vetting. They're culture creators. They're creating books that have been through many eyes. And my thing, and not for Cosmographia, but with Dream Your Book, it's more like helping aspiring authors learn how to become an author. And it might be, 10 years down the road, they can get into one of the better presses, or it might be sooner than that. And what I want to say is that, for example, I have a client, his pen name is Julian Foster, and he's an African American author, local, and he's writing these really raw and beautiful stories about the Rochester inner city, the fiction. But he's the kind of author that doesn't have any connections. He doesn't have doesn't have his master's degree, anything like that. But because he can self-publish, he can reach a huge audience. And he was looking at publishers of African American fiction, and I was helping him through that. And a lot of those presses look really poorly run, like they were going to try to take advantage of him. So self-publishing can actually be very empowering for certain authors.
I imagine, too, if it's somewhere where you already know that you have your market for it.
Yes.
If you've been engaging people through a blog or a podcast or what have you.
I think he went door to door to, salons and barbershops and city,
I don't want to get too far off the ebook question before we give you a chance to weigh in on it, Stephen.
We haven't done it yet. I think we're going to be doing. We experimented with one book that we didn't actually print a hard copy of. In fact, Nina formatted it for us, and so we did it as just a test, and it sold 7 copies. but that is something we're going to be doing probably with our next book, a Kindle edition, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the best ways to make money on an ebook is to price it around the same as your paperback. That's also if you want people to buy your paperback more.
I don't know about that. The Amazon's done a lot of studies and a lot of research on pricing points for ebooks, and based on basically watching what they do and how they change it, around $4.99 is where you can maximize your revenue and reach a larger audience, because it's very elastic in that the lower the price, the greater number of readers you'll have. Witness the thing that I talked about in Marfa when I gave my reading, that's part of my book about the rise of monster porn and the 99-cent monster porn, people being able to make more money than most lawyers and Boeing executives because they have capitalized on a very weird, very niche market and manipulated price and ratings and number of views at a particular moment in such a very specific and interesting way that they're able to make more than our foreign
owners. Yeah, I'm investigating a career option.
Yeah, I'm sorry. What I meant was, if you want to sell your paperback, that's a lot of the academic presses are pricing their ebooks around the same price as the paperback, and I'm not sure why that is, but I think that's, I said it wrong.
There's a sweet spot, they say, of pricing for ebooks, and you have to keep it between a certain range. I think it's $3.99 and $7.99. You'll sell more books in between those two prices.
But sometimes I want to find a kind of rare book, and the ebook will be $20, just the same price.
I don't understand
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you buy it at that price?
No. I would guess the paperback.
I'll say one thing we found at BOA is we do make all our books available as ebooks, but I think it's just the nature of poetry, and I'd like to think the nature of the quality of the physical book, too. People just want that physical book. That's what we found.
That's right.
This year, one of our big projects was making available our largest book, and one of the ones we're most proud of, The Collected Poems of Lucille Clifton, with a foreword by Toni Morrison. This is an 800-plus page book, so it took a lot to get that online. But we just launched it as an ebook. Always happy to have the books available in whatever format, because I want the poetry to get out there, but we've certainly found that people tend to prefer the physical object.
Yeah.
There's, especially with these sort of books, that's always proven to be the case, that the books that are of literary quality or poetry or of that kind of market, people tend to want to have the physical copy, whereas ebooks have traditionally appealed to people that are genre readers or something that you see as disposable. So it is if you're looking for a university book and it's $20 and the paperback's $20, you probably buy the paper book. But
if you want James Patterson's latest book shot,
and it's $3.99, I'm going to be like, well, yeah, I can just read that on the plane, $3.99.
We are talking about publishing with publishers here on Connections from WXXI News. Peter Connors, Stephen Huff, Nina Alvarez, and Chad Post are all with us. And Kathy from Penfield. Hi, Kathy. You're on with Connections.
Hi, thank you. I read a lot of poetry, and I do appreciate those publications when I see them. My question is, why are there so few poetry books that have an accompanying audio with them? I have some that do, Donald Hall and Richard Wilbur and some others, and I know there's great online resources from hearing poets read their work, but I love the paper copy, and I buy that, but I wondered why so many poetry books and poets do not have some accompanying audio with their work, whether it's because some poets read loudly, and I know that, and how do you handle that, or whether it's cost prohibitive, or people just don't want it, and there's not that much of a market for it.
It's definitely something that has come up, and in fact, it came up especially with this Lucille Clifton book. It's also come up with one of our poets, Lee Young Lee, who's an incredibly renowned poet and also a wonderful reader. To be honest, I mean, we've looked at it a few different times. Financially, it's a reach. With packaging it, with how to essentially ship the disc with the book, do that correctly, make sure we're producing the disc correctly. Make sure that the recording is the right quality and so forth. We're so focused on the quality of the objects that we put out, we just haven't figured out how to actually, first of all, pay for, and second of all, physically sort of get on top of how we can assure that the quality of that is as good as the quality of the written word. That said, I mean, there's so many ways to put that stuff out there online now. And we talk about, on-demand printing and so forth as being so revolutionary for publishing. To me, the biggest revolution that's happened for publishing in the past 10 years is social media. It has really put authors and small presses in the driver's seat for getting the word out about their books. And that includes, filming their own links, filming their own readings, putting up links to their own readings, whether it's in their own living room sitting in front of their phone or a large bookstore reading or whatever. So it's almost like in the meantime, while we've tried to figure out how to do what you're recommending, the social media aspect has sort of won over and made it a little bit even obsolete.
That's right.
All right. We need to get close to wrapping up the hour. Thank you so much for the call. I want to go around the table quickly here in our final minutes and get some summer reading recommendations. One title each. What are you reading this summer? Peter Connors from BOA. Go first.
Well, the one I'm going to recommend from BOA Editions, I think it looks like in September, in late September, we're going to have an author, Janice Harrington, in town for our big BOA event that we do every year. This one's going to be the 40th birthday bash for BOA. Janice Harrington, the book is Primitive, The Life and Art of Horace Pippin, who was an African-American painter, one of the most renowned African-American painters of his time, phenomenal artist, and it's all about him and his work and his life.
Stephen Huff from Tiger Bark.
I am going to recommend a local poet here. Tony Liuzzi, his book The Burning Door. He's a fine poet, and you can catch him reading around the area too.
Nina Alvarez.
The View from the Cheap Seats by Neil Gaiman.
Ooh,
essays.
And I'll go with Gesell Dome by Guillermo Sacamano. He is an Argentine writer, and it's a big fat noir book that will take you this summer to read, and you'll love it.
Excellent. Chad Post, Nina Alvarez, Stephen Huff, Peter Connors, thank you for being with us. We are back in the next hour with authors Rachel Hall and Lynn Rosen. Thank you to Kat Schwartz, our audio engineer, and our producer, Megan Mack. I'm Scott Feibusch. We'll be back with another hour of Connections.